Welcome to the ASP podcast. The American Security Project is a non-partisan think tank looking into some of the big national security issues facing us all. Today we're joined by Andrew Holland, a senior fellow here at ASP, specialising in energy and climate security. And our special guest, Cleo Pascal. Cleo is an associate fellow for the Energy, Environment and Development Programme at London's Chatham House. And she is the author of the book, Global Warring. And she's also a noted expert on the impact of environment and climate change on global security. So the big question, how does global warming, climate change affect our security?
It affects it in several fundamental ways. It affects access to resources, it affects energy, infrastructure, stability, it affects the cities, water supply, pretty much everything that we take for granted is built into the physical environment. And as the physical environment changes, it literally shakes the foundations of our society, our civilization, our economy, and our political structures.
And we've seen this changes in environment issues throughout long periods of history. But what is happening right now to make it this more worrisome?
It's two-sided. So first of all, the variability is becoming more intense. And climate change is one part of it, but there are other environmental change components that are also coming into play. So for example, groundwater depletion. Even without climate change, California would have a problem. There simply isn't enough water for Californian agriculture, for a city in the desert like Vegas, for a city like Los Angeles, to all exist with existing water supplies. So we're coming to a situation where on the environmental side, there's increasing scarcity and variability of supply. But we're also building in increasingly dangerous places, putting our infrastructure into locations where we wouldn't have built before. The London Olympics, for example, is in a lovely site, large flat chunk of land that was available because it's a floodplain and we haven't built on it for hundreds of years. So you've got the increasing variability on one side of the impacts, but also the increasing vulnerability on the other side because we're putting our things in the wrong place.
And how do you see this playing out for our security?
From an American perspective?
From a North American or a global perspective?
It's incredibly problematic because we're moving forward basing our assumptions on things like 1 in 100 year floods when the floods are coming every 5 or 6 years. It changes the fundamental economics and the risk assessments. So we are walking through a minefield at a time when economically we're already very thin on the ground, and politically there's increasing instability in a lot of places as well.
Andrew, what's
thanks, Paul. I think that this is very interesting and right on what the American Security Project is working on. Cleo, you've spent a lot of time recently looking at and working in Pacific and East Asia and talking especially about the rise of China. How does this interact with climate change, with environmental change? How is this playing out?
What we're looking at is a confluence of the three geos. There's geopolitical change with the rise of Asia. There's geoeconomic change, again, with sort of the rise of other economic power blocks and the decline of the West. And there's this geophysical change that we're seeing with climate change and other environmental change issues. In the Pacific, in Asia, many other places, we're seeing the three come together very clearly. So, for example, there's a lot of discussion about Kiribati having to be abandoned due to sea level rise. Kiribati is a country in the Pacific that we think of as a very small country because it has a population of about 100,000 and very little land. But because the islands are spread out over a large section of the Pacific, they have an exclusive economic zone about the size of India. So that's a lot of fishing rights, a lot of seabed rights, very geostrategic. Now, that population is in talks to move to Fiji, right? Mm-hmm. Fiji, because of the Bainimarama situation, was boycotted by the West. As a result of the Western boycott, China has moved in very effectively. So China has heavy political influence in Fiji now. So because of the geophysical change to Kiribati, the population of Kiribati moving to Fiji, China's influence in Fiji, you get a situation where Fiji suddenly potentially has control over a section of the Pacific that used to belong to Kiribati that is the size of India.
So
we've seen this last few weeks, China in the Pacific is trying to extend its rights, right up to the Philippines.
Yeah, we see it in the Philippines, all that.
Yeah, you see it all over. I mean, mm-hmm. China is, I don't fault China. They're doing what's in their national interest extremely effectively. However, our policy, and as I say our, I mean kind of the greater Western world's policy, has been failing to a large degree in the Pacific specifically. A lot of Pacific Island State partners don't feel like they're being treated as proper partners, and then China comes in and gives them whatever they want. We see it in Africa and Latin America, whatever. And so the loss of influence is substantial. But I think it's a combination of two factors. China very effectively engaging, and the West not so effectively engaging. If we upped our game,
Understood those three changes.
Yes.
The geopolitical, geoeconomic, and geophysical.
That's
you can understand those and react to them.
That's right. Because if you plan for just one or just two, you're not getting a complete picture.
Cleo, 3 years ago, back in 2009, 2010, we saw a number of reports, books, statements about climate change and security. And frankly, I think your book was one of the best. But since then, we've actually seen a number of real life examples. We've seen the fires in Russia. We've seen the flooding in Pakistan. We've seen the massive storms across the heartland of the United States. And yet, it seems like this is a story that kind of has been told, but isn't being retold. What do you think accounts for that, and do you think there's any reason for that?
I think there was a big push in 2009 to bring climate change forward as a security issue, primarily because of Copenhagen. And there was a concerted attempt to try to get countries like China to sign on to Copenhagen by saying, look, this is a security issue, so you need to sign on. Now, I think that was a misreading of where other countries stood. They know it's a security issue.
Mm-hmm.
They know that, or they thought that signing on to something like what was proposed to Copenhagen would then subject them to verification, mm-hmm. potential industrial espionage, all these sorts of other things, because what ended up being presented at Copenhagen had overtones more of a trade deal mm-hmm. than a scientific understanding
Absolutely.
Of how to move forward. So I think we played that card, we didn't play it particularly well, and as a result, a lot of doors got slammed shut. So I work a lot out of India. If you try to bring up climate change as a security issue in India now, they think what you're doing is trying to push carbon emission restrictions on them. And there's a big gap between climate change as a security issue and carbon emissions. And in that gap, there are a lot of things that could be done that aren't being done, because I think that card was badly played.
That's right. It was used as a political weapon instead of as a tool of actual analysis, and that's I think a problem. What else are you working on? Where else are you seeing this around the world? Right,
there are
now
several locations where the confluence of these three geos is quite mm-hmm. clear. The Arctic obviously is one of them. Another area increasingly is the South China Sea, as you mentioned, yeah. sort of with China moving into those chains of islands. A lot of those islands are tiny little chunks of coral outcroppings where they've stuck a couple of very unhappy Chinese soldiers to anchor a claim, and it doesn't take a lot of sea level rise for those to start to really disappear. And that shows up another element of the problem that we have. There's a disconnect between our physical environment and what we've physically built on top of it, but also a disconnect between our physical environment and the legal infrastructure that we've put in place. So the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, for example, assumes coastlines won't change, islands won't disappear, and as a result, we have a situation where if, again, Kiribati needs to be evacuated and the population moved to Fiji, does it legally cease to exist as a country? Do the waters become international waters? Does it lose its seat in the UN? Or does it get administered by a country like Fiji, a third country?
And of course, the U.S. is not a party to the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea, so we don't even get a seat at the table at this point to talk through these issues.
Yeah, and then the U.S. is also setting precedent, whether it likes it or not. There was an island, Mexico was using an island in the Gulf to try to claim a piece of exclusive economic zone in the Gulf. And the U.S. said, show us the island. And the Mexican Navy went out, couldn't find the island. The Air Force couldn't find the island. Satellite imagery couldn't find the island. It had been on maps for hundreds of years. So the Mexican said, well, obviously the U.S. blew up our island.
Obviously.
Yeah. But the U.S. position was no island, no claim. Now, that's actually not what we're seeing happen in other parts of the world where they're using historical islands to anchor claims. So there's real confusion, legal confusion in areas of high oil and gas supplies that's potentially going to create entirely new problems where the law is not going to help.
I mean, as I said, this goes into why ASP was founded, in the fact that we as a country here don't think about these issues strategically. It's a case by case. Instead of thinking along the long term about where we should be going and where we can actually make huge changes to the benefit of Americans and the West.
Yeah, I mean, this is a real tragedy. I think that a lot of countries would look to the U.S. for leadership on these issues. In the case of the U.S. has not signed on to the unconventional law of the sea, but perhaps it could raise this as an issue as it comes on board and say, for example, we'll freeze all maritime borders as per satellite imagery in the year 2000, for example. And if you do that, we'll sign on. And then start working some of the kind of areas that are a little fuzzier. You can work on them on a case-by-case basis, but at least you're not undermining the entire treaty.
Yeah. But I mean, the one thing we know that the world needs for the last 20, 30 years now is some sort of system to decide what a country is and how you bring on a country and how you dismantle a country.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there were attempts at it, like with the Montevideo Convention, but this is a new situation that's highlighting these longstanding issues. And again, you know, I would look to people like ASP to try to take leadership on this, because the rest of the world is by default in many cases going to China, because there is no, as you say, no strategic vision. A lot of these countries need long-term planning and engagement that changes on a year-by-year basis with partners that may be friends 1 year and may not be so much the next year, leave them very confused.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen the State Department try and put in these strategic partnership agreements, but it's taken a long time to get going.
Yeah, and I think there's also concern about as administrations change, will these partnerships actually
It's undercut by politics, and it's undercut by, you know, things that go on up on the Hill in Congress, and that, you know, in many ways don't have anything to do with this. But, you know, it's a system that's not working very well right now.
And how do you see this playing out in a positive way? How can we actually move things forward positively?
Well, the U.S. has many, many levers of positive engagement that are not being engaged. So, for example, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is a highly skilled group of men and women who could be engaged in places like the Pacific to help build seawalls or coastal defenses or things like that at relatively low cost. And it would help reinforce the security of allies at the same time as showing that the U.S. is there for its friends.
This is what the U.S. used to do in the 19th century, you know, in the early 20th century.
So looking at kind of non-political sort of very practical engagement that helps make our friends stronger. Throughout the Cold War, there's almost a policy of allegiances, not alliances.
Yeah.
We need stronger alliances across the board. We have to make our friends stronger so that they can withstand the 3GO changes that are coming down the line.
Which country do you think, which major country should I say, is most at risk with these three changes?
I think the U.S. and China are both at risk, and seriously at risk in different ways. The U.S. has a lot of infrastructure in highly, highly vulnerable locations, including a lot of critical military infrastructure. And there isn't a political will to confront that. So an example is Keesler Air Force Base, which was destroyed during Katrina. Now, this is a military base that should have been a center of stability for the region, but it was totally flooded out. So military resources that should have gone to securing the neighborhood went to securing their own installation.
Wow. Yeah.
Now, it was rebuilt in exactly the same location at the cost of $1 billion. Yeah.
$1 billion.
Okay. Right? Now, this is partially because no congressman wants to lose a base from their area. It's a high, you know, but when that happens in one base, okay, but the NIC has said there are over 20 bases that are similarly compromised. We can't afford to keep taking these hits.
Yes.
It has to be an understanding that this is a fundamental national security issue. The National Flood Insurance Program has to be revisited.
Yes,
we're
yeah.
subsidizing putting people in harm's way. You know, we have a lot of the agricultural policies are making an assumption about water supply and climate that may not be accurate. The U.S. may not be subsidizing the right crops in the right locations anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So there, yes.
I mean, I'm talking to several Republicans, friends of mine, who. You know, okay, there's the politics of all this, but they say it's a risk and you've got to work against that risk, as any business person knows.
Well, the thing is that the risk is being distorted, fundamentally distorted in myriad ways. So take a look at the insurance sector. The insurance sector is very good at assessing risk. And all along the coast, they've said these places are too risky to insure. The risk gets distorted when the National Flood Insurance Program steps in, and you end up with pieces of critical infrastructure as well as vulnerable Americans being put in harm's way. So yes, it's a risk assessment, but the risk is being distorted at a fundamental level. So I would highly encourage your Republican colleagues to turn to the market for help
yes.
in true assessment of risk.
And we've seen sort of the negative sides of this. Which countries will benefit?
Well, very few, because we have built assuming that the environment will not change. So any change
yeah.
is going to disrupt the foundations that we built into. You know, it's if you build a sandcastle above the high water mark, and the tide comes in. More, your sandcastle is
yes.
going to go. There's no benefit. You built assuming things won't change, and they're changing. Whether they get warmer or colder or whatever, that variability hasn't been factored into the design.
Cleo, you've written, I believe I read a year or two ago about, you know, Russia often assumed themselves that they would be the winners from this, but, you know, we see melting permafrost undercutting a lot of their Arctic pipelines and a lot of their Arctic oil infrastructure, as well as the fires that we mentioned before. You know,
yes. Yeah. I mean, there's an assumption that I'm from Canada, and there's an assumption that it's going to be great. Canada is going to be warmer, but you know, we have cities on coast that are going to flood. We have agriculture that's going to be short of water. We have infrastructure on permafrost that's going to thaw. We aren't designed to be adaptable. And the circumstances are changing.
Yeah.
That's it, period.
So, I mean, you could say, oh, Canada will do really well in 200 years. But
no.
Getting there is...
But we won't do well in 200 years unless we plan for 200 years. But also, infrastructure is designed minimum usually for 50 years, but is often in play. I mean, the Hoover Dam is now 80 years old. I mean, you know, our infrastructure is there. It's very big. It's very embedded. And it assumes everything around it won't change. So if we're building in that way, we're building for a specific time.
Yeah.
Now, if we're building for the 1930s, you know, then it suits the 1930s very well. But what's in the 1930s is not going to be what's in 2012. It just doesn't, it just will not match.
And I suppose there's the short-term shocks as well that we're seeing.
That's correct.
I mean, I read somewhere that the issues with the Russian harvest a couple of years ago affected the price of bread,
mm-hmm.
which clearly had a huge impact on the Arab Spring.
Correct. Yeah.
Issues.
Yeah, and what happened in Egypt affects Egypt's negotiating power over the whole Nile.
Yes.
And then you start to see China coming in with some of its partners along the Nile and putting in dams. So there's this cascading and rippling effect
yes.
that comes from assumptions made about the status quo of the environment that are extremely dangerous. And just in terms of infrastructure also, I mean, the other very vulnerable country is China, because they're putting in extremely large infrastructure projects, making these same assumptions.
We saw the dams could be flooding over this year.
Yeah, I mean, the dams are real, I suspect there are going to be very, very serious problems with those dams. Because the problem is not just the way that they were engineered, but also with corruption in the system. So there's questions about the quality of the concrete, the cost-cutting design issues, all that sort of stuff. But at a very fundamental level, you take a look at Shanghai. But Shanghai is a major global economic center, but it's like New Orleans. It's in a highly active delta, in a flood zone, in a typhoon pathway. So that, as a city, is an extremely vulnerable location to put your critical infrastructure into, which China has done. And it's worth bearing in mind that currently 8 out of 9 Politburo members are engineers. And they, in their heart, believe that they can engineer their
yes.
way out of these problems.
Yeah.
And as King Canute can tell you.
Yeah. You cannot stop the tide. Well, I just want to thank you so much for coming in.
Pleasure.
It's been, I've learned so much. Thank you very much.
Real pleasure.
Thanks, Cliff.
Thank you.